the wild world. Minsvia Bird Reserve was once kept sacred, shut up and apart from the world when the Avocets first started to breed there, maximum of 30 visitors a week. Now these precious birds can almost be taken for granted, and visitors come in their thousands and listen to bitterns and nightingales and clutes. Not so many willow warblers, though. These birds were once ubiquitous in Suffolk. Every lane, every thicket was full of that sweet, lisping descent down the scale. Not so many cuckoos either. Cuckoos were once ordinary birds, birds that turned up everywhere. Less than 20 years ago, it was nothing to hear one within the ring of the M25. Now to hear a willow warbler is a relief. To hear a cuckoo is an event. We've taken ordinary birds and made them special birds, and that's a disastrous way to carry on. But the ringing soundscape of Suffolk also tells us that we can, when we have the will, go through the reverse process and make special birds into ordinary birds, ambient birds, birds that are what they should be, part of the landscape. We become very good at looking after special places. It's the ordinary places we let go to pot. Suffolk Coast is a network of reserves involving organisations that were once almost rivals: RSPB, Suffolk Wildlife Trust, National Trust, Forestry Commission, English Nature. It was an early example of landscape-scale conservation, now rightly regarded as the way forward for wildlife conservation in this country. We look on the music of Britain as a national and a global treasure, something that enriches us all and is available to all. The music of the Suffolk Coast is every bit as much of a treasure, or, dare I say this on Radio 3, a still greater one. Greater because it lives, greater because it's so fragile, greater because it is, like the Suffolk Coast, forever changing, forever renewing. Each bird sings the song of life, which is the song of itself. When you watch a bird sing, you can see that it puts everything it's got into every song, quivering till you think it might explode. It means more than any human music ever can, because to every performer, every song means everything. It's not about life. It is life.
Simon Barnes on the Suffolk soundscape that was such an influence on Britain's work. The producer was Justine Willett. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, where the Suffolk Coast is a crucial protagonist in Britain's opera Peter Grimes, being performed in tonight's BBC Prom, live of course here on Radio 3, by English National Opera, led by their music director Edward Gardner. If compassion for Peter Grimes and Ellen Orford is at the heart of this score, then so too is a portrait of the unsympathetic, sometimes vicious folk of the borough.
Well, it's Britain's great achievement, isn't it, in his operas, that he won't pin anything down for you particularly clearly. And there's morality there, but there's also a horrendous mob and that sheep mentality that can be turned so easily to evil. And then there's this deeply complex, uncomfortable character at the centre of the opera. I mean, that's why the story's so intoxicating. You can't resolve what's right and wrong in it. And all Britain's operas have that element, and they're wonderful to explore for that reason.
Edward Gardner, as the promenaders tell us exactly what vast amounts of money they've collected. Fabulous, as always. Well, the orchestral interlude that opens Act 3 describes the profound tranquility of the summer night, but the jabbing phrases on flute and harp suggest the agony in Grimes's head and his inescapable predicament. It's a few days later, and a village dance is in full swing in the Moot Hall, just across the road from the Boar pub. The people of the borough are completely transformed from the pious congregation of Act 2. Now they seem drunken and debauched as the nieces try to escape the attentions of Swallow. Mrs. Sedley tells Ned Keane she believes the disappearance of Grimes' apprentice to be murder. He dismisses her theory, but she then overhears Bulstrode saying to Ellen that Grimes' boat is back and there's no sign of him or the boy. Ellen shows Bulstrode the boy's sweater, which he's found down on the shoreline. They decide to help Grimes as best they can. Mrs. Sedley tells Swallow of her suspicions. The crowd gathers to hunt Peter down, their excitement evinced in ever more frenzied cries of Peter Grimes. The final interlude depicts the despair of the half-demented Grimes, symbolised by the dense mist which has blown in from the sea, enveloping everything, and the mournful foghorn which accompanies it. Grimes is alone by his boat on the shore. In the distance are the sounds of the foghorn and the mob. The orchestra silent, his thoughts roam disconnectedly over the events of the past months. Memories besiege him. Every once in a while, his mind returns to the thought of home. He seems utterly lost, and his endless repeating of his name feels as if he's emptying himself. Ellen and Bulstrode approach him, and the captain tells Grimes to take his boat out of sight of land and sink it. Bulstrode helps Peter push the boat down to the water before Ellen and Bulstrode walk slowly away. Dawn breaks and the everyday life of the community resumes. Swallow mentions a report of a boat sinking far out at sea. "Just one of those rumours," says Auntie, before the chorus has the final word, singing of the endless motion of the work's other protagonist, the sea. So now, joining his orchestra and chorus on stage here in the Albert Hall, once again, E&O Music Director Edward Gardner. Act 3 of Peter Grimes.
Thank you. Get me to help them. They'll find there's no hell to pay. You just tell me where's the body.
In the sea, the apprentice lies, whom nobody has seen for days. Murder most foul it is, eerie I find it. My skin's a prickly heat, blood cold behind it. In midnight's loneliness, and feeling quiet, the history and race, the stifling secret. Murder most foul it is, murder most foul it is, and cold behind it.
Are you mad, old woman, or is it too much laudanum?
Has Peter Grimes been seen?
He's away.
And the boy?
They're fishing likely.
Has it not been seen?
Why should it?
His heart's abandoned.
I'm trying. Good night.
when us wanted here we oaksters.
Good night! It's time for bed!
Good night!
Good sirs, good night!
Good night! Good night! Good night, good night, good night!
In a moment, the company's gay with pretty young women and youths on the screen. So part like my roses, but now the sun's down, I'll water my roses and leave you mine!
Good night! Good night! Good night, good night!
Good night to the crab, all good friends, good night. Don't let the ladies keep company too late. Don't let the ladies keep company too late. My love to the maidens, wish luck to the men. I'll water my roses and leave you the wine.
Good night, good night, good night, good night.
My thinking, men who can breach the peace and kill convention, so many guilty ghosts with stealthy body.
Seems to have disappeared, not in his boat, not in his heart.
This I found down by the tide mark.
The boys,
I boarded anchor on the chest. Embroidered in charred, but as I long
him a hand.
We have no power to help him now. We have no power.
We have the power. We have the power. In the black moment, when your friend suffers unearthly torment, we cannot turn our backs. When honor breaks one heart, all hearts are broken, all are broken.
We shall be there.
We shall be there.
We shall be there.
We shall be there.
Let's go! the other slipped and died. And the third will...
Accidental circumstances.
What will drink his sorrows, my sorrows dry? And the tide will
gossip put on trial, bring the branding on, and I forward stand now is done for life. Come on! take away your hand! The argument finished! Friendship lost! Must be shouting! Everything said!
He's
a cross! To hell with all your mercy!
He's a cross! He's
a cross! To hell with your revenge! And God have mercy upon you! Do you hear them?
Peter, don't you hear?
Peter, Christ, Peter.
away from tidal waves, away from storms.
Help you with the boat.
No!
Sail out till you lose sight of land, then sink the boat. Do you hear? Sink her! Goodbye, Peter.
The ebb and flow of the tide, the implacable sea, has the final word at the end of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes, performed here at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall by English National Opera. John the Apprentice was Jacob Mason White, Hobson, Darren Jeffrey, Rector Stuart Cale, Bob Bowles, Michael Colvin, Swallow Mark Richardson, Ned Keane, Lee Melrose, the nieces, Gillian Ram and Mairead Buick, Auntie Rebecca de Pont Davis, Mrs. Sedley, Felicity Palmer, Balstrode, Ian Patterson, Ellen Orford, Amanda Rucroft, and that huge yell for Stuart Skelton, Peter Grimes, who just gave the most colossal bear hug to Edward Gardner, conductor of this performance. E&O Orchestra, led by Janice Graham. E&O Chorus, guest chorus master, Aidan Oliver. Quite astonishing energy and investment from Stuart Skelton. He said it was going to give it all. He's just punched the air at the chorus. That's what you call communication. Talking to the chorus in the intervals. They were just saying it was so exciting to be part of this, shining eyes they had standing behind the behind the orchestra. For one of them, his last performance in E&O service, Peter Kestner, 31 years in the chorus. And yet another of them who always gave 100%. Well, they've been here before, of course, E&O. They were here 9 years ago with Prokofiev's War and Peace, and 25 years ago with Act 3 of Parsifal, conducted by Reginald Goodall, who by a lovely happenstance was, of course, the conductor of the premiere of Peter Grimes. Well, in the theatre, the E&O production of Peter Grimes owed nothing to Aldborough as such, neither its Moot Hall nor its Shingle Beach, and a concert hall performance like tonight's proves similarly that because Britten's opera treats a theme which can apply to any community anywhere, it has a universal appeal and a universal significance. Aidan Oliver, the guest chorus master, just brought the chorus to its feet, and that shout is for the E&O Orchestra. Well, I hope you'll join me for breakfast here on Radio 3 anytime from 7 tomorrow, but for now, from an emotionally drained and also elated Royal Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to James Jolly at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thank you very much, Martin. That was Martin Handley. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow evening, when Oliver Nussen conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in music by Ger, Helen Grime, Debussy and himself. That's from 7:30 tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3. Last Saturday here on Radio 3, Sarah Walker uncovered the history of the orchestra who gave the first ever concert at the Royal Albert Hall in 1871, an amateur orchestra of aristocrats called the Wandering Minstrels. They were incredibly famous in their day. The song A Wandering Minstrel I from Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado was a satirical reference to them. But they've been completely forgotten, and their archive has only recently been rediscovered in the British Library. Among other things, it includes the score for an overture composed in the early 1860s by their conductor, the Honourable Seymour Egerton, who later became the 4th Earl of Wilton. And here it is, specially recorded for us by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Martin Yates. Seymour Egerton's overture, Endymion. The overture Endymion by the Honourable Seymour Edgerton. It was played by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Michael Yates. And you can hear Sarah Walker's feature, Wandering Minstrels, on the BBC's iPlayer until tomorrow lunchtime, which you can access via the Radio 3 website.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Sir Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic. Two consecutive evenings from this most celebrated of musical partnerships, starting with a programme that includes the suite from Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe and Debussy's Je, and in the following night's concert, the exhilarating second piano concerto by Brahms. The Berlin Philharmonic at the BBC Proms, starting Thursday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in anticipation of the Berlin Philharmonic's Proms visits next week, I thought we'd hear members of the orchestra's cello section, the 12 cellists of the Berlin Philharmonic, in an arrangement of Ravel's Pavane pour une infante défunte.
Thank you.
Ravel's Pavane pour une infante défunte, played by the 12 cellists of the Berlin Philharmonic.
To be a winner takes dedication, training, resilience.
If you are a split second too slow, you've wasted 4 years of training.
There's so much tension and drama.
Thousands and thousands of people cheering on the athletes.
You watch the clock ticking down, and then the gun goes.
And everything else is blocked out.
The only thing you can feel is your heartbeat.
The atmosphere will be absolutely electric.
And these will be the biggest and the best Paralympic Games that we have ever seen.
All the drama, all the big moments. The Paralympic Games. From next Thursday on BBC Radio 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra.
Now the essay. This week, writers have been recalling their experience of travelling by Interrail in the 4 decades since the past was introduced back in 1972. This evening, David Ullmond considers the decision not to Interrail but to hitchhike instead and how it affected him as a young would-be writer.
I meet my first Interrailers in the spring of 72. I'm 20 years old and I'm in the Watermill with Clay, swigging Newcastle Exhibition, going on about Sartre and Camus. She's talking about the summer. She's heard of an untouched corner of an undiscovered heaven. A couple at the next table spread out a map of Europe and start drawing long straight lines across it. They keep checking a big book of train timetables. Interrail, says the girl. Plan it right and you can do anything. £27.50, says the boy. Do it now before the gates slam shut. The gates, I say. You can only do it till you're 21. He loosens the collar of his Ben Sherman. After that, there'll be jobs, houses, families. I look at the audacious distances. Helsinki to Seville, Palermo to Lisbon. But to travel in a closed compartment, to rattle over straight steel tracks, to keep checking charts while Europe rushes by beyond the glass. This term I'm reading the existentialists and the surrealists. I'm scribbling stories that have no plot and hardly any punctuation. Claire leans past me and points down to Corfu. That's where it is, she says, in the north of the island somewhere. So, says the boy, it'd be Paris, Rome, Bari. No, says Claire, we like our freedom. We'll hitchhike there, won't we? Aye, I say. I wave a fake swirling route across their map, then back through Yugoslavia. She's made the leap of faith. I've gone and followed her. I swig my ex. Yes, we'll hitch. Each new lift, the start of a new, unpredictable tale. The term passes fast, and here's the breezy northern summer. An uncle gets me a month's work in the yards. I labour for welders, slither through hulls of half-built ships, lug tools down narrow ladders into cavernous tanks. Me muscles ache. I'm bruised and scratched. Head thunders with the din. This is what's known as bloody work, a foreman tells me on my final day. Make sure you never have to do it, lad. Be bloody free of it. Gander your grease and divn't come back. Another uncle, a bookie, unfolds notes from his waistcoat pocket. A tenner says you're safe and sound, and you know me number just in case. Just take care, me mother says, and send a card or two. And before I know it, we're outside Gateshead, by the side of the A1. We stick out our thumbs. It's inevitable. The car swerves to a halt, the door opens, and we're gone. We carried next to nothing. Little rucksacks, a few clothes, nothing too warm because we're heading south, a single yellow cycling cape to cover us both in the unlikely event of rain, a map of the continent that fits a single page, novels and notebooks, a return ticket from Victoria to the Gare du Nord, money enough, we hope, to get us there and back again. We spend our first night at a roundabout outside Fontainebleau. We shelter from the drizzle beneath the cape. There are dozens of hitches in front of us. The queue shrinks slowly, slowly. We keep waking, shuffling forward, shivering, dozing. A car horn wakes us in the grey dawn, and we find we're at the front. The driver sees we're cold and starving and buys us coffee and bread and cheese at a roadside cafe. He won't take our money. His name is Pierre, and he says he needs the ears of strangers. We need not listen, but he must talk. His destination is distant Chambéry, and the girl who has abandoned him. Does he seem like a wastrel, he asks us. Does he seem like he cannot become engagé? We shake our heads. Of course not, we answer. I gaze out at the villages, at the fields of sunflowers, faces turned to the hot sun. I read out Bouvet Chokey in a Geordie voice, and we giggle at how well it fits. The driver sighs. He is boring us, he says. Oh, no, we say. I smoke the Disque Bleu that he keeps passing me and encourage him to go on. He buys us lunch in a shimmering cafe garden. I drink Chokey, and we laugh again. I see that you will not leave each other for others, he says. Of course we won't, we say. This is her, he says, bringing out her photograph. Veronica. He kisses it and weeps. The villain is Francois. I do not think it will end in guns and knives, but how can I be certain of that? Then he grins and says that of course it may well end in joy, as these things sometimes do. That's true, he murmurs to himself, and onward we go on his little de chevaux. We cross most of France almost as quickly as if we're on a train. It costs us nothing. Remember me, says Pierre as he leaves us, and keep in mind Veronica. We lie in a meadow and look through the flowers and grasses towards the gleaming Alps. White snow, blue sky, yellow sun. There's a sound of a train nearby, its iron wheels on the iron rails. We move on lift by lift and tail by tail through Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne and Le Col du Mont-Cenis. We're picked up by a farmer and a tractor pulling a trailer of sheep. We rise slowly, twist and sway round the hairpin bends. He lets us out at the highest point, the highest place we've ever been. A train emerges from a tunnel far below and hoots and hurries on. We run across the slopes and flap our arms as if to fly. I scribble a tale about Pierre that ends with a knife in Francois' heart. After dark, we find a little dimly lit pension named Le Tremblant, where we drink bright green verveine and eat game terrine in the silent dining room. We sleep in a high oak bed in a little oak room. We open the shutters next morning. Light floods in and shows us we're poised right above a gorge. Metal girders keep us safe. A river rushes down below and mountains stretch into eternity. A couple of days beyond the Alps, we crash. We're in an ancient truck on the motorway below Milan. The driver leans forward to get a look at Claire, and the lorry lurches, sways and thunders down the embankment. Next thing is I'm lying in a field while Claire crawls out through the window of the upturned truck. A herd of goats watches from afar. Men scramble towards us. We're carried into a tiny Fiat and rushed to the hospital. Cuts and bruises, hardly worse than those from the shipyard. Doctors shine lights into our eyes. They listen to our hearts, our lungs. They plasma us and plaster us. We are lucky, we are told, but we are stupid. One of the doctors sticks his thumb out in imitation of hitchhiking. Never no good, he says. A pair of policemen wait at the door. They're booted, helmeted, gauntleted. They carry pistols in holsters at their waists. They drive us to the crash site on huge black motorbikes. We get our sacks from the empty truck. They hand us a sheet of paper and show us where to sign. Lira, they say. Lira. They point to the truck, to the fence, to the bikes, to themselves. It's a fine or a bill or a bribe. Who knows? But we have next to nothing, I say. Lira! I take out my thin roll of notes. The biggest policeman grabs it, then pokes my chest. It stings. I yelp. A fractured rib. What if we're injured more than they said? He suddenly holds up a finger. He cups his ear. Aha! He says. A train's rattling somewhere nearby. Is the driver okay? Asks Claire. I mime driving with my hands and arms, then close my eyes like I've been knocked out. Interrail! Says the policeman, pointing at the unseen train. Not auto stop! You will get dead very fast! Interrail! Their wheels spit grit as they roar away. I duck down and gasped to see the bloodstains on my sack. I'm about to say that we could go back into town and try to buy Interrail there. We could find out about the driver. But my heart sinks. I realise we hardly have the money for it now, and Claire's already sticking out her thumb. This time it's a VW van of Italian students en route for Naples. They see our injuries and give us cakes and wine. They give us cushions and tell us to rest. There's a woman lying flat on the seat at the back. They tell us she's Isabella and she must not be woken until the time is right. A girl at my side rubs scented oil into my brow. I fall asleep in the heat and wake to a rhythmical, storytelling voice. A beautiful man has his arm around Claire and a book in his hand. The Decameron, the man says to me, 10 days of stories from ancient days. He reads on. I don't understand the words, but I love the sounds of them. Sometimes he murmurs things that seem not from the pages of the book. She often smiles. A joint is being passed around. I take a drag, then sleep again. We travel through the night. The girl beside me sings Joni Mitchell. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Then I'm being shaken gently. The man kisses Clay. The girl kisses me. Isabella still sleeps. They give us a bag of figs and leave us below the slopes of Vesuvius. That day is slow. A couple of short lifts, an hour standing in the heat. There are many other hitchers from all across Northern Europe. They're heading for Greece like us and further, Turkey, Afghanistan, Iran, Nepal, far beyond the borders of our little map. That'll be us next time, we tell each other. The fields around are bleached and baked. The air's all shimmer and the roadway gleams. Lizards skitter in the dried out weeds. These are the days in which I think that sun lotion's a luxury. The skin will adapt as it has before. Burning's just part of the tanning process. But this is the Italian south, and the sun glares down and keeps on glaring, and there's hardly any shelter. That night we get a drab and stifling room above a country bar. My scalp throbs, my head roars, my face and neck are scorched. I crawl around the floor of the shared bathroom. I glug water from a rusty tap and I vomit. I glug again, vomit again. For no good reason that I'm aware of, I yell out, "Bloody inter-railers!" Back in bed, I have a heavenly vision of us sitting in a dining car, sipping orange juice as we're carried through a cold and gorgeous alpine valley. I groan and try to cast the impossible vision from me. Claire drops a sheet soaked in sour water across my head. Next day I can hardly move. We book another night. She spreads fig flesh on my damaged skin. It's good for it, she says she's heard. She reads Calvino in the bar below while I try to sleep and try to recover. She looks more languid each time she comes to check on me, browner, happier, more at home. I feel I'm going to die. I feel that this is the end of it. It isn't, of course. I heal and we move on and get to Brindisi and take a ferry to Corfu. We find Cassiope waiting for us in the north. We walk through the little town and across a headland to the turquoise water and the white beach. There are other travellers there, in couples and clusters. We drop our sacks onto the warm sand. We take off our clothes and wade together into the warm blue sea. And yes, it does feel like we've journeyed to a little bit of heaven. We stay a week or more. We get water from the village pump and eat souvlaki, yogurt, tough black bread. We wear necklaces of sunflower seeds. We swim for hours and we roar with laughter in remembering the bitter seas of home. We drink Retsina and Ouzo around fires with the others. We smoke Karelia cigarettes and talk of the absurd and the surreal. We buy blankets and sleep on the sand beneath the astounding stars. We talk of finding a way to move here forever. I fill a notebook with unpunctuated, meaningless tales. I write that every story is an unpredictable journey to an unanticipated destination. I write that the steel tracks of rationalism and logic are clamps upon the brain. I write that those tracks can never lead us to the borders of heaven. I write that there is not a single railway on Corfu. We become friends with Max and Maxine from Amsterdam. They're tall and languid, with waving fair hair and calm blue eyes. They have guitars and beads. They talk easily of their travels through the world. A shame we met so late, they say. They must head homeward next morning. Hitching, I say. No, they laugh. We are interrailing, of course. The story is predictable. It's a circular tale that follows the languid route I waved across the map in the pub that evening. But the return is more difficult, as return journeys always are. It's a long, slow climb towards a northern autumn. We really do have next to nothing now. Our food is bread and cheese and fruit. We walk through cities, from south to north, from one edge to the next, Belgrade, Zagreb, Munich, Salzburg. We sleep in parks, in bus stations, and in railway stations, where inter-railers hurry to enter the next stage of their schedules. Travelling from the Gare du Nord, I write fragments of the unfinished tales of Pierre, of the truck driver, of Isabella, of Max and Maxine. Back at Victoria, we pause. We eat sausage and chips, and we drool at the deliciousness of it. Then we think with dread of the A1. I phone my bookie uncle. He pays our fares in Newcastle. We get on the train at King's Cross. We open our tattered little map. We draw our route to Heaven's Edge and back again. And as the journey hurries to its end, we realise that it has made us glad.
This evening's Interrail postcard was written and read by David Almond. The final essay in this series comes from Diane Samuels next Thursday evening. This is BBC Radio 3, now World on 3 with Lopa Kotari.
Three, four.
Invisible System is bigger than the sum of its parts. It's an Anglo-Ethiopian collaboration with multi-instrumentalist and producer Dan Harper at the helm, rather than a band per se. With a guest appearance list that includes people such as Mahmoud Ahmed, Justin Adams and Adrian Utley, it reads like the who's who of music for Ethiopia and Europe. The track I played was Closer to the Edge, and it's on the Introducing Invisible System album brought out by World Music Network that brings together songs from the group's previous three albums and some as yet unreleased recordings. I'm Lopa Kotari, and tonight's World on 3 has echoes of last week's programme. Then too, I opened with a contemporary take on Ethiopian music. My guests in session tonight, Hazmat Modine, like Nation Beat last week, are also from the cultural melting pot of New York City. And although I don't have any music from demonic Polish gnomes posing as reincarnations of Chopin, I do have more new releases and love songs with catchy titles like Chicken Tikka Masala. This next song is a kind of love song. It's called Chidibim Chidibom on a debut album, 5773, from Judah Zay. The band's frontwoman is German-Israeli singer Maya Saban, whose influences range from multi-talented Brit rapper M.I.A. to America's Barry Sisters, popular singers from the 40s. The band says it celebrates the Yiddish way of life in the 21st century. Well, this song is about the rabbi who tells the gathered crowd that the dowry he's going to give his wife is something she hasn't already got, a bit of chidibim and chidibom. I'll leave you to figure out what it is.
Cada uma é como ela, e não me pensa no preconceito, não dá pé. Não se engana. vencerá a deputada.
Rainhas da Norte, Queens of the North, and the title track from their debut album, Cada Uma. They call their music Berlin Brazil Beat, given that the members of the band come from both Brazil and Germany. Now, Wilbur Calver is a passionate musician. 13 years ago, he took up the bagpipes and hasn't put them down since. He's also Cuban of Jamaican origin. And put all this together and you get a whole new music experience. Calver's latest album, Diaspora, out on Cadiz Music, is his foray into the African diaspora through the bagpipes. The tune I'm going to play is a good example of his sensitivity and undoubted musical acumen. It's called El Cumbanchero, a popular Cuban tune, but it's also the same tune as Rockfort Rock by the Scatolites. A cumbanchero is the name for someone who knows how to have fun, and in this tune, Calver certainly does. But before I play it, here's another passionate musical performance. It's from Latin Grammy-nominated singer Diana Navajo and En la Cabana que Habito, in the hut where I live, recorded live at the Quintero Theatre in Seville last July.